from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I'd like to welcome you to all the syndicated stations throughout the country, and we're broadcast all over the world. And therefore, we select our themes to empower people. Now, you empower people in two ways. One is by showing them the problems that exist and why we have those problems so they can help resolve them, or at least not be victimized by them. And then showing the positive results. That's what we're going to do today. My guest in studio, Chris Hedges, one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics and social and political activist and investigative journalist. He's also a Presbyterian minister and a visiting Princeton University lecturer. And for two decades, Chris was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America and the Middle East and Africa and the Balkans. And he was a reporter for the New York Times. And as a result, was one of the individuals winning a Pulitzer Prize. And that was in 2002 for reporting on global terrorism. In that same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Chris has authored many best-selling books. His most recent is America, The Farewell Tour, which is a deep on the ground look at what it means to have a society that once could take care of its population, where people could have a quality of life, and that has evaporated for at least 70% of all Americans. He also has a television program every Saturday on Russian TV at RT.com. Though right now there's a problem getting it in the New York area, and we'll talk with him about that. This is a part of this ongoing censorship. And I'd like to welcome to the program, Chris.
Thanks, Gary.
Chris, I'd like to go through several issues in turn. One is that most people on the left, the corporate left, and some in the intellectual left, have put all their energy on destroying Trump and nothing on creating progressive platforms that can actually help with the major issues: Citizens United, universal health care, demilitarization around the world. 67 cents out of every dollar, the newest figure, goes to military-industrial contractors and not to helping people. And so when I look at the top 40 most progressive issues, I don't find one being addressed. And yet the whole emphasis every day, all day, is attack Trump, attack Trump. And I've told this audience many times, I find Trump personally reprehensible on all levels, intellectually incapable of understanding issues, but let him self-destruct. Don't put 100% of your interest on him, because then you have no time or energy for anything that really matters to people. And within that context, I've been filming a new film on poverty. This is a sequel to Poverty, Inc., which you were instrumental in as well. And I'm filming people who were their whole life good Democrats. They were unionists. And just one example, and it represents a lot of people. This man said, my whole family and my family's family and I were always Democrat. We voted for all the Democrats. And we voted for NAFTA because we were told it would help jobs. It cost us jobs. It cost him his jobs. No apologies. They just kept doubling down until finally he just said, I've had enough. The left is not looking at disappointments and false promises and lost virtues. And they claim that it's all the Russians, all the time for everything, without looking at their own missteps. Would you address these, please?
Well, I mean, you're right. And Trump is the symptom of a decayed and diseased society. He's not the disease itself. The utter inability and failure of the ruling elites to examine the grotesque social inequality that has, as you said, affected the lives of 70% of this country means that the dislocation, the alienation, what Emile Durkheim calls the anomy that is gripping, I would argue, a majority of the American public, is not only unexamined, but is getting worse. And Trump is a product of a system that's seized up. Anytime a cabal seizes power, whether that's monarchical, fascist, communist, or in our case, corporate, it redirects the instruments of government, including those instruments that make piecemeal and reform possible, towards the further enrichment and empowerment of this cabal. And that we saw this with the latest tax cuts. What did these corporations do with this massive tax cut? They ran out and bought back their own stock, overheating the stock market. Why? Because, of course, the senior managers and CEOs, their compensation packages are tied to the price of the stock. But as Karl Marx said, it's this creation of fictitious capital, this use of money not to invest in jobs or raise wages or create employment, ultimately explodes in a kind of bubble. And it was the New York Times on Sunday had an article talking about the fracking industry being the new bubble because so much money goes into fracking, but it's just not a profitable enterprise. So I find the failure on the part of the self-identified liberal establishment to address this issue. The misguided belief that by the Democratic Party that Trump will implode, and that is a viable electoral strategy, one, by the way, Hillary Clinton attempted, and not just in the election but during the primaries. We know from the Podesta emails the Clinton campaign actively sought to promote Trump as a candidate. Demagogues are always vomited up out of these societies after people have just had enough being manipulated and lied to and betrayed by a ruling elite. And the anger is particularly fierce, as you know, towards the Democratic Party establishment because they continued to speak as if they were concerned and would fight for the rights of working men and women. So a small example to kind of buttress your point. In my book, and it's a book about the pathologies that are endemic within a disease society. So that's sexual sadism and suicide and opioid addiction and hate crimes. I spent a lot of time with hate groups, gambling. And I wrote that chapter out of the Trump Taj Mahal before I knew Trump would even announce. I was in Anderson, Indiana, where GM used to have many of its major plants, 25,000 good UAW union jobs with benefits, pension plans. People were making 25, 30, sometimes more an hour. Clinton signs NAFTA. By 2006, they're gone. I mean, in many ways, areas where these plants were, it's just huge bulldozed fields. I mean, they actually ripped the plants down. They went to Monterrey, Mexico, where they pay Mexican workers $3 an hour. Without benefits. And Anderson went into a death spiral, like many deindustrialized cities in the country. Everything's boarded up, abandoned houses, with all of the attendant problems that come with the disintegration of families and communities. I mean, the opioid epidemic is rampant in Anderson. So these old UAW workers, they voted for Bernie Sanders, most of them. But they weren't going to vote for Clinton. And the longer the ruling elites fail to address the most grotesque and pronounced social inequality in American history, and we've now surpassed the Gilded Age, the more you empower demagogues like Trump. I saw it. I covered the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times. And you had an ineffectual, self-identified liberal elite that could not address the country's economic problems. And so in a kind of rage at the system, you saw the elevation of figures like Radovan Karadzic, Slobodan Milosevic, Franjo Tuđman, very Trump-like. And we know that this is the root cause of what is creating illiberal or failed democracies, because we see it in other parts of the world where neoliberalism and corporate capitalism has created similar forms of social and economic destruction. Poland, Hungary, the rise of figures like Boris Johnson in Britain, and Brexit itself. We just watched 8,000 people led by neo-Nazis march through a city in Germany. France with Marie Le Pen, and Macron is kind of following out of the democratic playbook. So we don't have any much time left. The economy is extremely fragile. We will get another crash. Even very sober mainstream economists are saying this. The New York Times ran an editorial on this a few days ago. But they don't have a plan B. They can't lower interest rates below zero. And so what I fear is that we live in a period of relative stability. But should that stability shatter, especially given the, I would argue, moral bankruptcy of the left in this country, that's a recipe for a very frightening form of, in America anyway, a kind of Christianized fascism, which, of course, Pence comes out of. And I wrote a book, as you know, on the Christian right called American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War in America, where I spent 2 years with this group. And these people have an ideology, unlike Trump, who has no – is kind of an ideological vacuum. They're already filling this ideological vacuum. You saw it when he invited, 100 evangelical pastors, his 81% support. But this ideology – and I speak, as you said, I'm an ordained Presbyterian minister, a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. My father was a minister. I grew up in the church, so I'm hardly an atheist, or I come out of a Christian tradition. I look at these people as Christian heretics. You don't need to spend 3 years at divinity school as I did to understand that Jesus didn't come to make us rich. And they have fused the iconography and language of the religion, the Christian religion, with the state. They've sacralized capitalism, the worst aspects of American empire, including its racism, its bigotry, its Islamophobia, its homophobia. And in a moment of distress, especially given the evisceration of radical movements, this has been a decades-long process, but was accelerated in 1971 with the Lewis Powell memo and the infusion of corporate money and business interests into the academy, into the press, capturing the political system. Those of us who care about an open society and a populist, egalitarian, I would argue, socialism, are so weakened that I think we may very well get steamrolled. So I find I just told you I read this article, which is good. I mean, they don't like him, but it's still a good article in the New Yorker on Glenn Greenwald. And Glenn says at one point, I mean, this is the only resistance movement in human history. He's talking about, the identification with the Democratic Party, and that has made an alliance with the organs of state security like the FBI. I mean, it doesn't. And that, for me, is a kind of window into how politically immature and, bankrupt the liberal class, and I would argue much of the left in the United States has become. The whole demonization of the Russians, as you pointed out. The Russian government try and intervene? It certainly wouldn't surprise me. I was a foreign correspondent for 20 years and watched the U.S. government and the CIA try and intervene in almost the elections of almost every country I covered. But to somehow argue that Trump is a result of that is a way of not facing reality. It's a non-reality-based belief system, and one that the longer we embrace, the more imperiled we will become.
Thank you. I appreciate that overview, Chris. I'm going to ask you to look at an issue that is right in front of us, but it hasn't been formed and understood. And that is that all the time I'm told by experts that that all we have to do is deal with the 1%, and what they're doing and how they got their power, and that things will work out. It didn't make sense to me. So what I did is I went about actually looking for official statistics to show that we don't have a 1% and why we're not going to have change that way. And I found that we have approximately 17.2 million professionals in the United States, lawyers, doctors, engineers, accountants, CPAs, professors, with an average of nearly 4 people per family, 2 children generally. You're dealing with 68 million people. You also have 10 million millionaires. That means $1 million, not including their real estate holdings. And that means you have approximately 112 million people who represent what we now call the 1%. And then you look at their values. The careerist, not all, but many, every day is based upon getting ahead. And then a friend of mine who is a financial planner, he doesn't invest anyone's money, but he gives people guidance. Just recently he said that there's a whole phenomenon occurring that he's never seen in his 30 years in the business. Everyone that he counsels is now coming back saying, I'm cash strapped. Can you help unload some of these assets? And he was given, for example, an asset of a $80,000 Rolex watch that he gave to his, one of these guys gave to his wife. He said it can gift you about $11,000. A yacht that the guy's going to lose 95% on. And he says to these people, why are you selling your assets? You're making all this money. And they found out this, that the professional class is spending every nickel they make. They have no savings. The average worker in China has the world's highest savings, 47%. We don't have that. We have assets, but our assets are not liquid, and they always depreciate. So on the one hand, you have that. Then you have the millionaire class. Now, this is where it comes back to your, we're going to have a crash. This is that undercurrent, that riptide that no one can see when they're swimming until it rips them, that the millionaire class is borrowing in high-risk investments to get a higher return. And that's all done on not just leverage, but on paying as little as 2 to 4% down. That's worse than it was back in the great, right preceding the Great Depression. And that hasn't been called in. So they got to make a big return. So they're going into very risky situations, options, derivatives, credit default swaps, etc. So everything that fueled the original crash back in 2007 is back on steroids. There's currently $466 trillion that just 5 banks now hold in credit and derivatives. And that is also before Obama passed the bail-in bill on Christmas Eve, the last year he was in office, which means that if the bank fails this time, all the money in the bank goes to the bank, and the people who have the biggest investment and the derivatives are the ones who get the money, which can wipe out most people. Because then you're not simply considered a person who's putting your money in the bank, you're considered an investor in the bank. So I'm looking at people who claim to have wealth and do, but have debt exceeding it. So that led me to the second part of this equation. So at least when we're talking about something, we're talking accurately. So we don't have just 1%. The real 1% is about 0.01%. Right. All right? But what you have is you have approximately 28% that have real wealth and are spending it. There's the kids that go to Harvard and Yale, go to NYU and spend $67,000 just on tuition, who'll buy their kids a, you know, apartment in the area for $1 million. They can afford it, but they can only afford it based upon their capacity to create debt. So there's a place on the Upper West Side near where I live, and I heard about it. It's a restaurant that caters to millennials. And you go in at night. I walked in last night. I had a meal with a lot of our BAI listeners, where I've been for 42 years. And it was simple. We'd have a meal and socialize for 3 or 4 hours, and they'd give the station $25, right? So it pays some salaries. But on the way, everyone had left, and I was walking home. I go in this place. It's 11 o'clock. It's packed. And the cheapest beer I saw there was $50 a beer. These are so-called, you know, local brewer beers. And the average kid had maybe five beers in front of him. Well, you and I going to college, we didn't go out and, you know, have $500 to spend just on beer, right? And a Boar's Head sandwich was $80. Now, those are kids that are a combination. The very rich who never question what something costs and know the value of nothing. And the professional classes kids who want to emulate that and who therefore the kids have the credit card, but now the parents have to worry about how am I going to pay this. And so you got this two groups who are not concerned about the environment or citizens who have more power or third-party candidates. In fact, they're completely detached from the reality of the world that they live in because they're living in a bubble. So we have 20% of the entire population in a bubble. Now, when you have held demonstrations, and you and I helped lead a demonstration at Bank of America, where we joined arms down there, right? We had 8,000 people. I ask, how many are your professionals? Only a couple. Where are the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, the architects? Where are the professors? Come out. This is about you. Forget it. When they're tied up in their own minutia of living, they forget the world they live in. So they're not going to stop eating meat. You became a vegan because of your conscientiousness towards, your conscious towards the environment. 18% of all global warming is methane. So if we could do more to solve global warming than if we gave up all cars, trains, planes, buses, and ships by just stopping meat. In any case, these people are not going to give up meat. They're not going to give up luxury. They're not going to give up their 15th Louis Vuitton handbag at $20,000. They're not going to change anything. So they're living at that, what Aristotle called the concept of pure pleasure, hedonic pleasure. And within the hedonic pleasure on a curve at the low end, you have decadence. You have so much self-absorption that there's nowhere to go. You just immerse yourself in it. And all these reality shows about it's all decadence.
Yeah.
And people are supporting this. And my final thought was, well, how does this, can we get out of this hole that we're digging ourselves into? And the answer is not the way we're doing it. Why? Because I took the gross domestic product, $20 trillion. I used the government's own figures and I looked at every kind of debt, personal debt, credit card debt, student loan debt, state debt, city debt, federal debt, and unsupported debt on entitlements, and it's $200 trillion. Well, we're talking about Greece being a basket case of debt to gross domestic product at 324%. We're 1,200%. We're totally bankrupt. And there's no way that when you have 1,200% debt to gross domestic product that you're going to reverse that. But because we're powerful, and we have this powerful machine, and because the dollar is currently the leading currency, we think we can float through this. And when I look at our debt, and I look at how people are spending their money, and I look at who's got money and who doesn't, and that we're not helping the people, we're not deghettoizing the city, we're not helping people who are poor, we're criminalizing being poor, we're debtors' prisons that were banned in 1833 and now back, I'm asking, how can we continue in the media, the left and right media, and our major spokespersons, and the people who are the policymakers, how can everybody be living in such denialism?
Well, that's why the book's called America, the Farewell Tour. And as Alfred McCoy points out, the day, and it's coming, the dollar is no longer the world's reserve currency, which is a kind of fictitious valuation of the currency. We're finished. We can't afford an instant contraction of these futile and ridiculous military fiascos that we have perpetuated now for 17 years in the Middle East. Imports will become incredibly expensive. And what's most dangerous is that the elites don't have another mechanism to respond to a crash. They can't lower interest rates to zero. We saw central banks in Europe actually paying corporations to borrow money. You're right. I mean, and what we've seen, in addition to all of the facts that you point out, is that they have borrowed the money. It may be roughly 0% interest, or marginally beyond 0%, and it does have to be paid back. But because they're not producing anything, they are extracting this awful debt peonage on the public. Student loans are now almost $1.5 trillion. Much of this can't be paid back. The housing bubble has returned, you have these usurious rates on credit cards. So if you're late, you're paying 28%. That's why they have to keep wages stagnant because debt peonage, which is also a form of social control, as any African-American understands, is the only way they can suck this money out from the bottom, from those people who have already been tremendously hurt by the downturn, to pay back the money that does have to be paid back. It's not a sustainable system, as you point out. And what's worse is that we don't – this time around, we don't have any kind of – or the, let's call it the financial community has no rational response. And that's the moment that worries me because, as we talked about earlier in the show, the failure on the part of the left to respond to this system in – a meaningful way to offer any kind of a vision to replace it, empowers those kind of powerful proto-fascist forces within the country, and not just the Christian right, but all of these nativist, you know, white hate groups. And we are already seeing out of the Trump White House, but not just out of the Trump White House, all these politicians, the guy running for governor in Florida and elsewhere, who are copying Trump's overt racism and bigotry and incitement to violence, sanctioning of violence. And America, as Richard Hofstadter pointed out, is a deeply violent – we are a deeply violent culture, unlike, let's say, Canada. We believe it's part of our national myth that violence is a form of purification, that we can regenerate ourselves through violence. The gun companies through the NRA have flooded the civilian population with automatic assault rifles, these AR-14s, and which are not used for hunting. In fact, as somebody who used to hunt, they're useless because of the caliber of the bullet. So it's we're setting ourselves up, I think, for a very frightening period. And you have all sorts of people ringing the alarm bells, but of course they're shut out of the mainstream media, which is corporate dominated.
Totally censored.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look at it from a spiritual point of view, because I've watched a lot of your lectures, and you bring that spiritual quality in. Because at one end is our authentic self, and that's where we see clearly, understand, we'll listen non-judgmentally, look at all the pieces coming together, see what makes this puzzle work. And at the opposite end of that is a highly conditioned epigenetic mind that is extremely vulnerable. And if you apply negativity constantly from the social media and from politicians of making you fear the other, the day comes when you no longer look for the sacred in anything or anyone. You simply look at what is going to protect me in this moment. Ah, that group will protect me. And then you start seeing what evolves from that. And we just don't seem to be having discussions on this as if this is not important. For example, I look to see when was the last time MSNBC or Rachel Maddow discussed the U.S. role in Yemen. Now, it just doesn't exist. In the last 12 months, it's non-existent. Then I went to other sources, and I'm finding that no one in the media is talking about the U.S.'s role and that Saudi Arabia's role and the United Arab Emirates' role. These are the three main characters there. But also, other countries are selling weapons to get this thing going. And how can you stop a problem if you're not honest about it?
Well, and I mean, we haven't even raised the point that they won't discuss capitalism. They won't discuss in any meaningful way the corporate coup d'etat in slow motion that seized control of the country. They won't discuss in any meaningful way the predatory nature of these corporations and what they're doing. I mean, it's Ralph Nader, he calls them traitors. If you look at the idea that somebody who loves their country seeks to protect it and promote it and nurture it, and Ralph's right. So, I mean, I don't own a television, but so obviously you can't escape it. You know, it's on in an airport or the gym or somewhere. But you look at CNN, and it's just 24 hours of burlesque. Yeah, speak as a former newspaper reporter. It's endless gossip and trivia, and it's good for profit. CNN made more money last year than they've ever made, I think $1 billion. But it's, the porn star and her lawyer who wants to run for president and Omarosa and...
I'm holding up a porn star who wants to run for office. To follow up on this, would you address this, please? Here is Vogue. They dressed up the porn star and her lawyer, and they talk about the new strip club fans are, quote, the resistance. Now they're portraying her, Stormy Daniels, as this high-virtue person who had the courage to take on the president, and therefore she's part of this whole new feminist movement and young people. And it goes into talk about how she says that now the people are not the old people that used to come to my, to put me in financial good condition. Now it's the it's migrants, it's women, and gays, all right? As if this is the future that's going to change America. Here's my thought. I'd like yours. A, she cheated on her husband. She committed adultery. Normally, when someone commits adultery, they have to be very shrewd in how they do it to keep from getting caught. And indeed,
but now you release tapes about it, sex tapes, don't you?
Yeah. So now she here's an adulteress who then accepts over $100,000 to keep quiet about a sex act that happened some time ago, and then goes out to play this as far as she can possibly play it with this attorney that seems to show up everywhere. Now, this was hundreds of minutes on CNN.
Yeah,
all easily. Right? And not a word about Yemen.
Right.
Not a word about the cholera epidemic in Yemen, which is the biggest cholera epidemic, including bigger than what was in Haiti a few years ago. Not a word about all the children who are dying every 24 hours there.
Well, and not a word about the almost 3/4 of Americans who are suffering and have been rendered invisible by these media.
Why, Chris?
Because it's all about profit. It feeds into this reality show television poison that has seeped into our political life. And that didn't begin with Trump. That evolved through the public relations industry. So they, going all the way back to George W. Bush, the man you want to have a beer with, they create these manufactured personalities, and they're very skillful at eliciting an emotional response to these manufactured personalities and getting us to confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. I mean, Madison Avenue is nothing if not highly sophisticated, as well as insidious and evil. And what we saw, as Matt Taibbi points out in his book, Insane Clown President, which are his essay, quite good essays on covering Trump, is that Trump just played this game better than they did. He had a manufactured personality. I mean, you and I are from New York. We know that this guy was a disaster as a business person, multiple bankruptcies, defrauded his investors, cheated his contractors who often went bankrupt. But they created that persona on The Apprentice, and then that persona was sold to the American public. And Trump just proved better at the game than Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton. And so all Trump and everything we see, I didn't know that Stormy Daniels was now going to run for office, is part of the moral and intellectual evisceration of public discourse, of political life, and the consequences of that are truly frightening.
How could anyone say that she is a new feminist hero when she knowingly committed adultery with a man that she knew was married at the time? So she not only betrays her own husband as an adulteress and manipulates that, she then selects someone who is a high-profile, wealthy person. You don't hear her having an affair with a poor, you know, plumber Brooklyn.
If Donald Trump was driving a cab.
Yeah, wouldn't have happened. All right? So you're then going to give confidence to this person? I mean, what have we become as a society when the worse you are as a human being, the more attractive you are to other human beings?
Well, when societies decay, look at the end of the Austro-Hungarian Empire or what happened in the late Roman Empire, the decadence that grips the culture propels the, you know, Trump in many ways, or even Daniels, it's a reflection of our own decadence. It's a reflection. We talked a little, you mentioned the, that kind of spiritual element, that idea of the sacred. It's when everything is commodified. Human beings become commodities. The natural world becomes a commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse. It's the celebration of the perverted values, which are championed on every reality television show. And they are the values of psychopaths. They are the ability to manipulate and lie, a lack of empathy or remorse, a belief that the attainment of either celebrity or wealth, or hopefully both, is its own justification. It doesn't matter how you get there. It's unbridled narcissism and hedonism. And unfortunately, and forms of indoctrination have created it, we as a society have become deeply corrupted, as late empires often do. So in the late Roman Empire, you're coughing up these figures like Nero and Caligula and Commodus and others. You have the facade of the Roman Republic, but it doesn't really exist in the same way that the American democracy does not exist. We still have the institutions and elected officials, but of course, once they get to Washington, the lobbyists write all of the legislation. You use an utterly mendacious language to describe your reality. And, you know, go back to the left. Every time I hear the left, people on the left attempt to deify the founding fathers, I just want to fall over. You don't have to be a history major to understand that these were white slaveholding elites who lustily embraced the genocide of Native Americans and were terrified. Read the Federalist Papers of any kind of popular democracy and created all sorts of mechanisms like the Electoral College to prevent popular will from having any form of expression. That's why they turned on Thomas Paine, who became a pariah after the Revolution. And I think this goes back to my book that this is so much graver than Trump. This is about a society that has lost the capacity for the sacred. Nothing has an intrinsic value beyond a monetary value. We all have been sucked into this, I would call it, if you want to go back to my divinity school training, idol worship. That's what Facebook is about. It's about self-presentation. It's about it's about me, the life movie, as Neil Gabler says in his book. And it's completely fake. It's completely hollow. And of course, it only fuels the kind of alienation because we lose touch with who we are. It atomizes, as Hannah Arendt writes about, a society. When you're constantly presenting yourself, whether it's on Instagram or anywhere else, you are creating a kind of small, mini, fictitious persona that is a version of the very large fictitious personas that are created in Hollywood or created within the political sphere. And we have to break free from that. We have to get back in touch with not only who we are as individuals and as a country. And James Baldwin writes about this, the inability of white Americans to grasp what they have done to African Americans. And, you know, as I speak, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of incredibly courageous and heroic men and women inside our prison system who are on strike, work stoppages, boycotting commissaries, and they understand, I think, better than we on the outside do, that if you want to end slavery, and it is under the 13th Amendment, a form of slavery. There are many states that don't pay any wages, and in most states you're earning about $30 a month, is to stop being a slave. And where are they? You know, they don't they're not good entertainment. They expose an uncomfortable truth about who we are as a country and the horror of mass incarceration. And so they're blanked out, as I think anybody who seeks to be self-reflective and self-critical about the country is blanked out.
Thank you. That was very interesting. Last evening, I'm always, when I met with these people, or just listeners, in the last 2 days, one of the people was an opera singer, another was a classical pianist, and another a professor. And one of them said that she supported Barack Obama and was one of the organizers in New York, and also Hillary Clinton. And so she said, "And what can I learn from my association?" I said, and I spent about 20 minutes going back to where I'd done the original investigations on the Clintons in Arkansas, and then who backed them, from Winthrop Rockefeller and to Harriman, of, you know, Averill Harriman's wife, who was one of the top people in the Democratic Party. I said, "Do you ever think that before someone is elected, they're first selected? These people are groomed. And if you're a person of power, if you're an oligarch, if you're an industrialist, and you want to make sure that your industries are protected from legislation or regulation, are you going to select someone who is deeply flawed or very moral and ethical?" And she said, "Well, I don't know." I said, "Well, think of it. If you," and I mentioned your name, I said, "if you had a Chris Hedges, or you had a Cornel West, or you had a Ralph Nader, you're not going to compromise them. I mean, whatever they believe is the truth, that's what they're going to follow. They're not going to be induced by any rewards to change the truth to suit you. So historically, you find the person who is most charismatic, but also most flawed. And because that's a person you know you can control, because you know their flaws, you know their weaknesses, you know the skeletons in their closet." And everyone knew what was going on with the cocaine and everything else in, you know, Arkansas, and all the politics and his womanizing. He'd already bragged to his a lover of 29 years, who I've interviewed, who's a lawyer in Texas, that that he had bragged about having sex with 3,000 women before he became attorney general. That's how long ago this went. They knew all this. Then come to New York, when he was just being introduced here. And at that time, a couple that were very close to me were going to be the people sponsoring the Clintons in New York. And these are among the most powerful liberal democratic families on the East Coast. And so they asked me to come to a meeting, to meet with them. And I said, "I don't want to meet with the Clintons. I know all about them. And why are all these people coming?" And here's what the wife said. And she was very up and honest about it. She said, "Gary, none of us like the Clintons. All the people I talk to, they know about the Clintons. These are people that run industries. You know, they have resources they can find out anything about. But they know that Clinton will protect them. You give the Clintons money, you're on their wish list. You can then get protected. They're going to get contracts. And when you're president of the United States, it's different than being the governor, different being on a city council. You get the big contracts. You get the no-bid contracts. You can make billions and hundreds of billions of dollars over the period of that person's. And that's why these people are coming." Well, there were about 40 people who came to meet them, right? And these were the liberal Democrat leaders of New York. And I was told, now I didn't speak with these people because I didn't want to go, and I was told none of them liked the Clintons. They liked his personality. They were very fearful of her because she was the bright one. She was the one. He was the smiling face out in front of the world. But she was the one who was controlling everything. But they backed them to the hilt and continued to. The same is true of Obama.
Yeah.
His whole myth about him being a community organizer, it was all lies.
He was selected by the Chicago political machine, which is the dirtiest machine in the country.
And the family, one of the most powerful families in America,
yeah.
Who own the hotel chain, right? And so selected, then elected.
Right. That's how it works.
So why don't we ever have this conversation?
Right. I mean, and this is all these people who think we're going to get serious reform within the Democratic Party. You touch exactly on this point. Schumer, Pelosi, none of these people would hold political power but for Wall Street and corporate money. And the power of a Pelosi or the power of a Schumer is that they are the conduit of this money to the selected candidates. And so this gets to the core issue, which is all of this, I would call it false hope in serious reform ever coming out of the Democratic Party is a dangerous form of self-delusion. The structure of the party is such that the people who run the party without that kind of money wouldn't exist. They wouldn't hold political office. And they, however decayed the ship of state is, they would rather go down in their first class cabins than give up their privilege and their power. And that is a fundamental truth about the Democratic Party, which isn't even a political party the way we define it. The base is irrelevant. It doesn't make any decisions. And we saw with the Sanders campaign. I would argue that the campaign was stolen.
That's a fact.
I believe it's a fact. I mean, that you have the outright theft of the Nevada caucus, but you have all sorts of rules. I mean, for instance, in many primaries, independents were not allowed to vote in the primary, even though, of course, the taxpayers pay for the primaries because they knew those were Sanders supporters. You have the whole issue of the superdelegates. We know after the fact that the Democratic National Committee was just an appendage of the Clinton machine, creating all sorts of obstructions to the Sanders campaign. And that, although if Sanders was president, he'd be completely paralyzed in a Republican-dominated Washington. But I think he would have beaten Trump. I think that that diversion into the belief that Russia stole our elections, this is the next Pearl Harbor, is a very dangerous myth that points people away from the social inequality, which is now only mounting after these tax cuts, which is one of the most grotesque thefts of taxpayer funds. I mean, it's going to remove an estimated, according to the New York Times, $1.5 trillion from federal revenue over the next 10 years. And of course, they will then use this as an argument to privatize Social Security, destroy what's left of welfare, which has already been destroyed, remove food stamp programs. And then on top of it, we're watching everything get privatized. This is what Betsy DeVos is doing. Why are we privatizing schools? Well, the federal government spends about $63 billion a year on the public education, and the hedge funds want it. It is, as Marx understood, the quality of late stage capitalism when these corporations prey and devour the very institutions that make a capitalist democracy possible. So the kleptocracy, which has been part of American society for a long time, you correctly pointed it out with the Clintons, is now naked and turbocharged under a Trump administration. But again, none of it is new. The reality television aspect of it is not new. The capture of corporate power, complete control by corporate power, is not new. The lies and mendacity, although they're more vulgar and transparent with Trump, Clinton, there wasn't much that Clinton said that was true. As you pointed out, trying to sell NAFTA as the creator of American jobs, reforming, quote unquote, reforming welfare. I mean, every time I heard Hillary Clinton talking about her concern for children, when Clinton destroyed welfare, 70% of the original recipients of welfare were children. Glass-Steagall, which is ripped down the firewalls between investment banks by abolishing Glass-Steagall, Canada didn't have a banking crisis because they didn't allow their commercial banks to be turned into hedge funds. Deregulating the FCC, which has now concentrated the media, especially the electronic media, into the hands of five or six corporations, including Comcast that controls MSNBC. So all of these trajectories are ones that go back decades, including an unchecked military. I mean, the the bloated military budget, these wars, which are only good for Raytheon and Halliburton, and you know, now we want to watch Eric Prince wants to privatize the war in Afghanistan. It's gone so well. It's just insanity, and it is all of the flashing red lights of an empire in deep, deep distress. And unfortunately, among the wider public, because public discourse is controlled by for-profit entities that care – we haven't even talked about climate change – that care far more about entertaining and about amassing revenue, we're not even able to discuss reality.
Yesterday afternoon, I was called and said, Gary, you got to watch this show. Now, Robin Leach just passed away last week, and he had been the person who founded the Lifestyles of Rich and Famous. And this was a show that was so over the top that it made his old shows seem tame by comparison. Like a couch that Lenny Kravitz designed that's $40-some thousand. It showed a Hollywood mansion that is $38 million. What makes it cost $38 million? It's someone gives you the perception that by being on this hill instead of that hill a mile down,
right,
you should pay more. And then there was a next segment was on a yacht. Now, it's a nice-looking yacht, but it was $250,000 a week to go on the yacht and to sail around any place you want, not including food and cabin, which came to $400,000. And I'm thinking, who's got $400,000 extra for a week to be on a yacht? And then it was about a guy who brings special jewelry to people's homes. That is, it looks godish and it looks Las Vegas-y, if you know what I mean. It's just gauche. But these huge baubles, oh, here's a 68-carat ring. And it's only a discount of $20 million. Right. And you're wondering, who's buying this? Who's paying all this money? And that's that group of people, unfortunately, out there who see that and think whether I can afford it or not if I can tell people I did rent a yacht. And so I hear at the auctions how a poor Picasso painting goes for $100 million now, or a painting that wasn't even proven to be done by Leonardo da Vinci goes for the highest amount ever, almost $450 million to the ruler of Saudi Arabia. And you're wondering, what is the value of what they're buying and how best could that money be used? And today, everyone glorifies people who live in excess, how much they can spend. The Kardashians, the whole vacuous family, and all they do is talk about what they're eating, where they're going, and how famous they are.
And it's an important point, Gary, because what we are fed is that we can all become them.
Yeah.
And that's the myth. We can all become Elon Musk. We can all become, Bill Gates. We can all become Kim Kardashian. And you go down to the kind of micro level. As I said before, on social media, that's what we're all yearning to do. That's how powerful this very dark form of indoctrination has gripped the society. I mean, television itself in a poor house is an instrument of violence because it constantly holds up a lifestyle and creates, I would argue, even a kind of schizophrenia between how most Americans are living and the aspirations, and they're fed this idea that if they don't have it, they failed. There's no examination of a system that was so gamed against them from the beginning that they never had a chance. The kind of eclipsing of rational self-critical discourse and public radio and public television is very guilty of this. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember that in the 60s, you could watch Malcolm X on public television. Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky was not blacklisted. Ralph Nader, one of the most respected voices in America. And now PBS is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Koch brothers. That's why the news hour is such a snore. And so the censorship, given the gravity of our problems, is and the instilling of this false notion that we can achieve what is dangled in front of us on these electronic hallucinations is dangerous.
I agree. Thank you very much, Chris, for coming in. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll, Chris Hedges in studio, and don't forget, you can watch Chris's program. You can go up on rt.com.
rt.com/oncontact.
Okay, and you can watch Chris Hedges and also his new book, and it's an important book. The title of your book again?
America, the Farewell Tour.
Great. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for watching. Have a nice day.
Just move on up toward your destination. Though you may find from time to time complication. Keep on wishing.